everyone, and we start a smidge early, so some people might be still wandering in. But my name's Nick Heggett. I'm on the organising committee, and delighted to introduce this session today. The genesis behind this session was to step outside tax for a little bit. I think a lot of people are seeing through their businesses and private practice the ACCUs and carbon offset projects, and certainly I think what the committee had found was it's really helpful to understand the framework behind that when you're coming to look at the tax issues and how these things are set up. So I'm really delighted to have Naomi Hutchings, who's an executive counsel at Herbert Smith Freehills in the environment and planning area. Naomi brings a wealth of experience from private practice, from working in-house and actually also working for government on these issues. So she really brings a diverse perspective to all of that. We can't entirely escape from tax. So at the end of the session, Tristan's just going to quickly run through some of the tax rules that impact on carbon offset projects and particularly the tax treatment of ACCUs. I'm sure some people know, but not everyone knows we've actually got a special division in the Tax Act. So those that haven't been introduced to it, Tristan will introduce you to that. So without any further ado, I will pass over to Naomi.
Nick, good morning everyone. As an environmental lawyer, I never ever thought I'd be presenting at a tax conference, but how the world changes. So thank you very much for having me in. Hopefully I'm going to explain a little bit about the regulatory regime around the safeguard mechanism, the ACCU scheme and eligible offsets projects. So what we're seeing this year, since the introduction of the safeguard mechanism reforms, they're really driving demand for ACCUs. For those who have had blinkers on, the safeguard mechanism is the Australian government's primary means of requiring Australia's highest greenhouse gas emitting facilities to reduce their emissions in line with Australia's emissions reduction targets. So there were changes made just over a year ago, in July 2023. The safeguard mechanism has been around for a long time, since around 2016, but the changes have really resulted in a significant uplift in demand for ACCUs. We're now seeing a really significant participation in Australia's domestic carbon credit markets. That's not just from safeguard facilities, but intermediaries, government, individuals like farmers, as well as overseas investment. So ACCUs and safeguard mechanism credits are the primary means for safeguard facilities other than strong carbon abatement technology changes. But ACCUs are required for those harder to abate emissions reductions to meet legislated baselines. And companies are now mitigating against carbon price and compliance risk by securing longer term supply of ACCUs through project participation, through third parties and intermediaries and long term offtake agreements, as well as forward contracts. So an understanding of the regulatory overlay is essential as a first step in demystifying what an ACCU is and ACCU markets. So today, I will go through the safeguard mechanism. Hopefully that's sort of a recap for people, or it may be entirely new for some. The ACCU scheme, I'll talk a bit about eligible offsets projects, and then Tristan will talk about the tax regime. Hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for questions at the end. So the safeguard mechanism reforms have been implemented to seek to achieve targets to achieve the Australian government's 43% reductions by 2030 and net zero by 2050, noting that there's a lot of news in the media around whether or not those emissions reductions targets are going to change. The NGER scheme, or National Greenhouse and Energy Reporting Scheme, and the safeguard mechanism, like I said, have been around since 2016, and they apply to around 215 industrial facilities, with the trigger of facilities emitting more than 100,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. Safeguard facilities are required to keep their net emissions below a baseline emissions limit. And what the reforms introduced was a mandatory baseline default decline rate set at 4.9% each year to 2030, and then industry average benchmarks to apply post-2030. There are new flexible compliance mechanisms, including being able to generate safeguard mechanism credits if emissions are achieved below a baseline, and there's also tailored compliance for emissions intensive trade exposed industries. So responsible emitters is typically, in most circumstances, the entity that has operational control of a facility. They're the ones that are required to ensure net emissions are below baseline, or meet or are below baseline. I mentioned safeguard mechanism credits. They are a new creature of statute. If an SMC is earned, they can be sold and used by other safeguard facilities to meet baseline, but they won't be akin to ACCUs. They'll be able to be used by safeguard facilities, but not more broadly. There's also an option to apply to borrow baseline from the following year, or a multi-year monitoring period. So if a company doesn't meet baseline, then an excess emissions scenario will exist. A facility will need to surrender approved carbon credits, so ACCUs or SMCs, on the Australian National Registry of Emissions Units. And ACCUs can be bought from the Clean Energy Regulator, with the price set at $75 for this year, and then indexed in future financial years by CPI plus 2% each year. And to give you an accurate picture, the current ACCU spot price is around $40, so there you see the significant incentive to de-risk carbon costs. In case you're interested, there is a relevant legislative framework behind this: the NGER Act, the Safeguard Mechanism Rule, the Carbon Credits Carbon Farming Initiative Act, or the CFI Act, and rule that the Australian National Registry of Emissions Units Act and regulations. That's a key legislation. It's also, this market is highly regulated because ACCUs are financial products, so you also need to reference the Corporations Act and the ASIC Act, Anti-Money Laundering Act, the Competition and Consumer Act for unfair contract terms. Native title also comes into it. And then state legislation like the Land Act or Land Title Act, which creates separate property interests in carbon rights, and the Carbon Rights Act in WA. So the ACCU scheme used to be called the Emissions Reduction Fund, and it's a voluntary scheme, and it allows eligible projects to earn ACCUs by undertaking different types of projects, which are called eligible offsets projects. So ACCU scheme participants will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by effectively storing carbon by using new technologies or processes. And they include projects not just carbon farming, but activities like savannah fire management, so burning up in Northern Territory or Queensland, burning off savannah, energy efficiency improvements, landfill gas collection, waste reduction, and other agricultural practices, like changing agricultural practices. One of the methods is called the human-induced regeneration method, which is now expired, but a lot of early projects got up through the HIR method, and that involves changing grazing, beef, or grazing management, and changing the practices of how to manage beef, mostly up north. So once a project has an eligible offset project, they are able to earn ACCUs by way of a certificate being issued by the, once it's a project has been audited, a certificate is issued by the Clean Energy Regulator, and then they will be entitled to have ACCUs issued into their ANRU account. Once you've got an ACCU, you can buy and sell it on the secondary market, which is a voluntary, not regulated market. ACCUs can also be sold to the federal government through entering into a carbon abatement contract, which effectively provides certainty by being able to deliver ACCUs at a fixed price through fixed or optional delivery. That is currently under review. Safeguard facilities, in addition to separate projects like reforestation, safeguard facilities themselves can also earn ACCUs, but there are tight rules around how they can earn ACCUs. So they can't earn ACCUs for activities where they're required to reduce their covered emissions, and they can only add new activities that reduce covered emissions to existing projects, so it's quite limited in scope. In terms of demystifying ACCUs, I thought I'd talk a little bit about what an ACCU is. So an ACCU represents 1 tonne of carbon dioxide equivalent, which is either avoided or sequestered through an eligible emissions reduction activity. It's a unit, a regulatory unit, issued to a person by the Clean Energy Regulator by making an entry in an account kept by the person in the electronic Australian National Registry of Emissions Units. As I've mentioned, it's a tradable financial product and it's also personal property. It's not proprietary interest. So the registered holder can pass, is the legal owner, and that legal owner can pass good title to another person. You can also create equitable interest in ACCUs that's not prevented by the Carbon Farming Initiative Act. So security can be granted over an ACCU. You can hold ACCUs on behalf of others, for example, a trust. The ANRU, the registry, does not record the existence of security interests in ACCUs, but you can perfect them by registration on the PPS register or by control. So a little bit about the registry. It's administered by the Clean Energy Regulator. It's a secure electronic system. There are currently reforms proposed to increase the sophistication of the registry and given the to promote liquidity of Australian carbon markets. It is critical to have an ANRU account that's capable of receiving ACCUs and transferring them. But ACCUs can be surrendered and cancelled on behalf of others, so you can make voluntary cancellations on behalf of another entity, either in the same corporate group, or there may be a carbon services provider that an entity can say, I need to surrender these ACCUs in order to meet my baseline, and they can do that on your behalf by making an entry. Authorised reps can be nominated to perform all of those registry functions, and you can also have joint proponents of an offsets project. But you've got to appoint a nominee to receive the ACCUs. So eligible offsets projects, in order to carry out a carbon farming project, the project proponent needs to have the legal right to carry out the project, and they need to maintain that legal right for the duration of the project. So you need to have evidence of either freehold or a lease agreement, or a carbon covenant, for example. You also need to have the lawful and exclusive right to be issued all of the ACCUs from the project and undergo a fit and proper person assessment. Then, if you qualify, then you've also got to get your project up and running. Projects must be new, so they can't be related to activities that have already started. And so there's some tricky rules around the newness requirement, particularly around a project achieving FID. They also need to go beyond business as usual, so you can't get credits for a forest that's already there. They can't be required by law, so they can't be a project that is, for example, you've got an environmental approval that requires you to restore vegetation because you've cleared it. That's the additionality rule, so it's got to be something that's entirely fresh. You also can't already be receiving financial support, and it can't be an excluded activity. It needs to also follow the rules of the applicable method. So it's really, it's not a simple thing, and it's really important to conduct technical and legal due diligence. When I say technical due diligence, I mean companies are getting experts around how much carbon can be sequestered. A lot of these activities are being conducted on really marginal land, and they don't always achieve, they might not always be able to achieve appropriate sequestration of carbon. And in terms of legal due diligence, there's a really complex interplay of land access and interests, including native title, landowners, mortgagees, banks need to give their consent, and it's not an easy get up and go type process. So the methodologies under the CFI Act are statutory instruments, and you can search for them on the legislative website. Once registered and eligible, then a project proponent needs to report against how they're achieving progress with the methodology, and then they're also audited. And some methodologies have more auditing than others, so HIR projects, there was a lot of problem with the integrity of HIR projects. There are quite a lot of cowboys out there in the early offsets, eligible offsets market. So the Clean Energy Regulator, in the wake of an independent report that occurred last year, has been ramping up their auditing of those types of projects in particular. I have already mentioned some of the other methods that can be applicable. The other thing to note is recently the government has announced that a proponent can nominate their own type of methodology and get that. And we've seen a few of those. For example, there's a few traditional owners that have proposed certain methodologies to be able to earn ACCUs. So we'll see how that sort of evolves over the next year or two. So registration is a bit of a key thing. In terms of getting registered, the CER makes a declaration that the project is an eligible offsets project, and that declaration can be conditional or unconditional. I've seen a lot of conditional registrations which are subject to what's called eligible interest holder consents. I haven't seen many subject to other regulatory approvals, but the EIH consents really have tripped people up a little bit. So an eligible interest holder is a holder of a carbon right, or it's a freehold owner, like a landowner, mortgagees, native title, registered native title holders. So that in particular has tripped some proponents up, where they've got their project up and running, they've delayed getting native title consent because you don't need to get consent for a period of 5 years. And then the time, they've underestimated how long it takes to get native title consent. And then they run up against that 5 year period. So the CER has responded to this, and their new best practice requirement is to seek consent up front, which is going to create a few issues for some in terms of factoring that in before they've properly got financing and properly got a project up and running. Mining tenement holders are not eligible interest holders, so there's also an added overlay of complexity there. The interesting thing, or I find it interesting, but is the permanence obligations that attract to some of these projects, particularly all vegetation methods. So the purpose of a permanence obligation is to make sure that the ACCUs are only issued for carbon stored in the soil and vegetation and are not released back into the atmosphere, which has the results in reversing the environmental benefits. You've got to choose a permanence period for either 25 or 100 years. There are benefits in 100 years in that you would earn far more ACCUs and qualify for discounts on those ACCUs, but it's very difficult to get a project up and running unless you've got freehold title for that 100 year period, and most proponents that I've seen are nominating for 25 years. You've got to prove to the Clean Energy Regulator how you're going to keep that carbon maintained by submitting a permanence plan. And then one of the key risks that we're seeing is how to deal with the risk of what's called a reversal event, including both controlled and uncontrolled events like fire, and how to convince a landowner, for example, that they don't want to change their mind halfway through, or they might not be able to earn, they might be able to earn better money by, I don't know, putting a renewable energy project on their land or doing some sort of cropping type venture. So the real kicker is that in the event of what's called a significant carbon reversal, so if, you know, for example, if the whole thing burnt down, a project proponent is required to notify the Clean Energy Regulator and either restore those lost carbon stores, or in certain circumstances, they'll be asked to relinquish the ACCUs that have been earned over the project for the life of the project. So if you think about a project, if that happens in year 23 of a 25-year project, that's quite an expense. But I must say this is meant to be used as a tool of last resort compliance. So if someone's not behaving, the Clean Energy Regulator can impose a carbon maintenance obligation, which attaches to the title and requires not only the project proponent, but also the owners and occupiers to do certain things, not to reduce carbon stores further. So there's a real incentive, or not incentive, but it's a kind of a hard stick to say, once you've got this up and running, we really want you to keep it there. There's a role for carbon service providers. They play a pretty critical role. So they're sort of the experts. They will enter into, they can do everything for you. They enter into commercial agreements with landholders. They will generally provide a carbon service agreement. Some of them do it for a nominal fee, others or a fee. Some of them want to be paid in ACCUs, which again is, can be quite high, like 25% of all ACCUs in order to do these services. The regulator's again cracking down on some of the carbon service providers because there again has been a bit of lack of integrity. It's quite a new market, so there's always things that need to be ironed out. They also need to be a fit and proper person and can't contract with landholders and landowners on unfair terms. So in terms of monitoring and compliance, CER has got, they're quite a good regulator, they're quite active. They do a lot of auditing and monitoring. They also announce what their focus area is going to be for the year ahead. They're focused at the moment on the provision of making sure that information and reports are accurate and complete. There are numerous offences, including fraudulent conduct, providing false or misleading information. There have been a number of enforceable undertakings where proponents have been required to enter into an undertaking for 2 years because they've been doing the wrong thing. There are also pecuniary and administrative penalties. And then, as I mentioned, there is that major penalty of being ordered to relinquish ACCUs over the life of the project in the event of a significant reversal. So the Chubb review was a review conducted last year to ensure that ACCUs and the carbon crediting framework was strong and creditable. There's been a number of recommendations made, some of which will be implemented. We're seeing a few, like the proponent-led method development, which I mentioned. The native title consent is still out there. We haven't seen any legislative amendments yet. So we'll see if that comes in next year. I also wanted to mention biodiversity certificates and co-benefits, which you may have heard of. The Nature Repair Act came in last year, or maybe it commenced this year, and it establishes a framework very similar to ACCUs, a legislated national voluntary biodiversity market. Certificates, again, can be issued in a similar way to eligible project ACCU projects, which can then be sold. It says that it will allow for alignment with the ACCU scheme, but that it remains to be seen how that will align, because there haven't been any specific rules or methodology determinations that have been issued yet. So we'll see, they're aiming to develop this market in 2025, but we're yet to see how it will actually play out. Co-benefits is another buzzword, I guess, that you might have heard. The ACCU scheme can provide other direct benefits called co-benefits, And examples of this include things like increasing biodiversity or the use of traditional management practices. ACCUs that have co-benefits attached to them are likely to attract a premium price. And the registry identifies which ACCUs have co-benefits, but they don't verify them. So someone wanting to buy ACCUs of that nature needs to work out how to verify them themselves. So that is a very brief overview of the regulatory scheme. I'm probably a little ahead of time, which will give us more time for questions. We'll see how long Tristan can talk on the tax considerations. So I'll hand over to him.
Thank you, Naomi, and good morning, everyone. As foreshadowed, I'll now talk briefly a bit about the tax issues in relation to ACCUs and carbon farming activities. Hopefully this will provide a bit of a lead into the next session after the morning tea on the tax treatment of environmental and decarbonisation costs. Now, looking at this slide, I did ask our legal assistant to include some photos in the presentation on some different examples of carbon farming activities, and to me, being a tax lawyer, not an environmental lawyer, this could be an example of savannah fire management. Having said that, I'm not sure if she was also trying to tell me something by including a photo of fire and firefighters alongside the introduction to the tax part of the topic. Now, as Nick mentioned in the introduction, Division 420 of the 1997 Income Tax Assessment Act is a specific regime that deals with the tax treatment of registered emissions units, or REUs, and registration refers to an entry on the register under the ANRU Act, as Naomi mentioned before. They're defined to include Australian Carbon Credit Units, ACCUs, also Safeguard Mechanism Credits, SMCs. Sometimes the provisions refer just to REUs, sometimes they refer specifically to ACCUs that are issued to you from carbon farming activities under the Carbon Farming Act. So that is something to keep in mind. Now, for the most part, the registered holder or the legal holder under the ANRU Act is also going to be the holder for tax purposes under Division 420, although there is a specific look-through rule for nominee holdings, in which case, if you've got a nominee registered holder, you can have the beneficial owners, you know, on a look-through basis being regarded as the holders for Division 420. 420 also has some deemed source rules for income that's recognised under the division, which could be relevant for foreign residents subject to the application of a double tax agreement. It also contains exclusivity rules. If you're in Division 420 for recognising deductions or income, that basically trumps everything else in the Act. So for relevant expenditure and receipts in relation to holdings and dealings, or dealings I should say, in REUs. There are also some specific exclusionary provisions in other regimes to make it absolutely clear that they don't apply, such as in the trading stock rules in Division 70, in CGT, and also in the taxation of financial arrangement provisions in Division 230. CGT, there's an exemption both for dealings in ACCUs and rights to receive ACCUs under the CFI Act. However, as with tax, as we all know, it can be complicated. There are then exclusions within Division 420 for when certain matters are not recognised, which then takes you out and you've got to look elsewhere. The main exception, I think, which is worth noting, is expenditure on the carbon offset project activities themselves. In those cases, you're going to have to look to other provisions such as general deductions, Division 40, etc. To add to a further confusion to that exclusion, then there's then another exception, which I'll get to, which brings you back into Division 420. Other one to note is that ACCU derivatives, as opposed to the ACCUs themselves, they're not in Division 420. That may be a case where the TOFA rules apply, particularly if there's no underlying ACCU delivery in relation and you've got a financial arrangement. Somewhat similarly, for GST purposes, the supply of an ACCU is GST free, but the supply of an ACCU derivative could be an input tax financial supply. And finally, technically, the holding costs of a registered emissions unit are not covered by Division 420, although given their nature, I doubt that they're going to be significant in practice. And financing costs for example, acquiring ACCUs or conducting carbon farming activities, again, you won't be in this division. So it is relatively limited in scope. So although it is ACCUs are not dealt with by Division 70, the trading stock regime, Division 420 is, in very broad terms, a type of trading stock position or system. You don't need to worry about capital revenue characterisation for a particular holder. It's effectively a deemed revenue treatment. And as I mentioned before, there are the specific CGT exemptions. As already noted, so when you're doing your carbon farming or carbon offset project activity, for the most part, the costs related to that, you'll need to look elsewhere. The exceptions, which are covered in Division 420, are sort of more of an administrative nature. If you're preparing or lodging an application for a certificate of entitlement to ACCUs or an offsets report under the CFI Act, then you can claim deductions for that expenditure under Division 420 in the relevant income year in which you start to hold the ACCUs. If you acquire ACCUs on market, well, that cost would generally be deductible. There are the standard sort of market value substitution rules if you're not dealing at arm's length or if you're dealing with an associate. However, the market value substitution rule, you don't get a doesn't apply for the ACCUs issued to you for carbon farming activities under the CFI Act. You don't get a step up for the purposes of a deduction. Similarly, if you dispose of the ACCUs on market to a third party, then that amount will be recognised as assessable income, again, subject to market value substitution rules. The good views on the converse side is that the market value substitution doesn't apply if you surrender the ACCU to the Clean Energy Regulator, and you also don't have a capital gain. And finally, if you've got incidental costs in relation to a sale or surrender, they're also deductible in the year of the disposal. So that all sounds pretty straightforward or pretty standard, what you might expect. However, the one thing I thought that was worth noting when I was having a look at these rules is what's known as the rolling balance mechanism. So a little bit like trading stock, which you may be familiar with, there is an adjustment at the end of each year. You look at the tax value of the registered emissions units you hold at the end of the year, and you compare it to the tax value of those that you held at the beginning of the year, and if you increase, you've got an amount of assessable income. You decrease, you've got a deduction, which in practical terms, you might think often effectively defers deductions of acquiring ACCUs until you actually dispose of them in a future year. There are a few different methods, a bit like trading stock. There's a first in, first out cost method, an actual cost method involving tracing, or a market value or a mark-to-market type method. The interesting thing is that, of course, the ACCUs that are issued to you under the CFI Act, you haven't actually bought them or paid for them, but for the purposes of the rolling balance provisions, you do get an effective market value substitution based on the value when they're issued to you. And why that matters is that if you still hold on to them in the same income year, you haven't disposed of them, but for Division 420 purposes, you would be assessed on that value all else equal because the value of your ACCUs would have increased. It's effectively taxing an unrealised gain. Now, on the other hand, when you eventually dispose of them in a future year, that should wash out. If you've got a surrender, you'll get an effective deduction in that year. If you sell, then you've effectively got a balancing adjustment for any change in market value in the meantime. But it is nonetheless a timing issue to keep a lookout for. Interestingly, I found that this is a timing issue that is specific to ACCUs that are issued under the CFI Act to you for carbon farming activities you've carried on. It won't apply, for instance, to SMCs or ACCUs that you buy on market, which could lead to some interesting choices as to when you surrender or dispose of different types of units. One other thing to note, as I said, there is an elective choice as to what type of tax value you adopt in a particular year. There are some restrictions to try and prevent gaming or arbitrage across different years. If you pick a method, you've got to basically use that method for at least 4 income years in which you hold REUs at the end of the year. You also can't switch from FIFO to actual cost, and there's also limits in terms of trying to pick more than one method. Typically, you've got to pick the same method for the income year. So something to keep out, I think in particular that that was a little bit counterintuitive to me, that ACCUs that you'd obtained from carbon farming activities and you hadn't yet disposed of, you could be taxed on at year end if you still held onto them. I'll make some brief comments on some tax considerations when it comes to structuring for carbon offset projects involving multiple proponents. These will probably be relatively familiar to many of you in the audience. They're quite similar to the sort of tax structuring issues you'd consider for a joint venture or a resources project. Of course, there are a range of other issues, not just tax, that have to be considered when it comes to structuring, commercial, legal, financing, etc. I'll try to stick to the tax comments. But as you know, probably at a high level, the main choices are an unincorporated joint venture, a partnership, or some sort of incorporated joint venture involving a special purpose company or a unit trust. And as people would be familiar with a UJV, you've got direct holdings in assets, direct effectively flow through of tax treatment, losses and income. For the participants, you will have a taxable event on a sell down, and a buyer who's coming in could face a stamp duty cost if acquiring dutiable assets, particularly interests in land. A partnership's quite similar, although for legal reasons, the joint liability means that people tend to prefer a UJV to a partnership. Of course, if you've got an IJV, a company that's a separately legal and taxpayer entity, it'll be a taxpayer. Losses won't flow out. You'll need to consider franking for dividends, 45B, and other issues and for returns of capital, all that sort of good stuff, which we're familiar with. Again, tax on sell down of the shares, a CGT event. Maybe you could do an issue of shares if you wanted to introduce a new participant, but obviously then the money would go to the IJV company itself. Maybe you would use that for activities, but it could be quite difficult to extract that in a tax efficient manner, particularly to other shareholders. Stamp duty, you need to consider the landholder rules. Typically it's majority interests when it comes to a company, although you need to consider aggregation, and as we know, it's a hot topic, which was discussed in one of the sessions yesterday. Unit trust is somewhat similar, somewhat in between a UJV and an IJV in terms of tax flow through. Slightly different issues when it comes to distributions. The other thing to note is that the stamp duty rules, again, you're usually in the landholder rules, but they're not always the same as for companies. You can have a lower threshold to trigger a relevant acquisition in a landholding unit trust. It could be 20%, in certain cases in Victoria and New South Wales, or even zero in Queensland. So that's something to watch out for as well. So a few final comments from me. So yes, ACCUs and safeguard units, as I mentioned, perhaps nothing to take away from this session. They have a specific regime, Division 420, which can trigger tax timing issues if you hold on to them, particularly ACCUs that were issued to you under the CFI Act. Of course, you should also consider the tax treatment of the carbon offset project activities themselves. Not just income tax, but other taxes such as state taxes, stamp duty, land tax, things to keep in mind. One interesting potential issue is, depending on the nature of the project, whether you're eligible for a land tax exemption. There are exemptions involving primary production, although where it's a project that is focused on generating ACCUs, you might run into some issues there. So that would be one interesting scenario. When it comes to joint venture structures, often, as we know, an unincorporated joint venture is preferred because of the tax flow through treatment for tax losses and depreciation. But if you have new participants coming in, or you expect them to come in over time, that can lead to additional costs, you know, income tax costs on disposal and stamp duty costs for the entrants if they're acquiring direct interests in the assets. If that's what you're dealing with, maybe you want to consider an incorporated joint venture such as a company, subject to, you know, things like the carry forward loss rules if you've got changes in interests over time, particularly for a unit trust. Nonetheless, maybe that is an alternative to use a special purpose company rather than a UJV. That was all I had to say on the tax side, a bit of a quick tour. Got a bit of time left. I'll now hand back to Naomi to wrap up.
Thanks, Tristan. So we've got quite a few questions that have come through, so hopefully a bit of time left to get through some of those. I think the key message is that the ACCU scheme projects present very different risks, compared to a resources project, and not to underestimate those risks. Due diligence is absolutely key. Also, an understanding of ACCU markets is really important. There's a complex regulatory overlay and policy overlay. I always go back to the policy and what is trying to be achieved by the introduction of the regulations. And that includes not just in the CFI Act, but also the other regulatory overlay, including the Corporations Act, AFSL issues, all the tax considerations, and anti-money laundering. The market is a really interesting one. It's quite diverse and it's continuing to evolve. There's also a lot of push to ensure that confidence and integrity, as well as transparency in the scheme itself. There are very different project risks to consider. I mentioned the significant reversal of carbon, how to apportion liability, the newness requirements, and when you can actually get started on the project, and the costs involved with getting a project up and running. There's also a really interesting interplay between the types of counterparties here. So they can involve landowners like pastoralists, banks and financiers from overseas, native title parties, as well as state governments where Crown land is involved. So there's kind of a mix between very sophisticated players and not so sophisticated. And it will also depend on what type of project is being undertaken. In terms of getting really large scale ACCU projects up and running, a lot of proponents are looking to really get this happening on large tracts of land, which involve far more significant amounts of money and entering into lots of different sort of project structuring configurations. And that's another factor that should be considered. The sort of overarching point is that it's also critical to have an understanding of how your company is decarbonising and what the decarbonisation plans are, including when ACCUs are going to be needed and required, because that will impact the pricing and when ACCUs are required to be procured and how quickly that needs to happen. And I see some of the questions that have come through relate to carbon markets in that regard. So that was all we had. And I'll go and sit down.
It's good, obviously, people are interested in this topic. So I'll let Naomi sit down, because they're mostly for you, Naomi.
Oh, no. Hopefully I can answer.
There was a question about tax effect accounting, but
I'll pass on
that. I've declined that one because neither Trista and I know much about that, I've got to be honest. So you'll have to ask someone else about that one. But Naomi, the top voting question is ACCUs acquired from CER? Where does CER get them from? Do they have a limited supply, or do they work more like a penalty?
That's an interesting question, which I have not looked at, but I suspect because they are a creature of statute that the CER creates them and then provides them as an incentive and surrenders them. So it's not on the same market. It's a regulated. It's a, you know, these are, we create them ourselves. And what was the second part of that? Do they work more like a penalty? Sort of. In as much as they are there for, the CER's there to provide an incentive to enter into the ACCU scheme. So for project proponents, they're an incentive. If they can't get anyone to buy their ACCUs, you can always sell them to the clean energy regulator. But then the $75 price, that is, works like a penalty. And that is trying to force big emitters to get their act into gear, to get their plans, to do deep structural abatement early on so that they don't need to rely on buying ACCUs in order to surrender them at a very high price at a later point in time.
That all makes sense. Interesting question around ESG and transparency. There's a few questions. And so one of them is, should multinational enterprises be more transparent on where their carbon credits are coming from? And if so, should this form part of the annual report suite of docs or a separate publication? I know you mentioned that there can be add-ons to the carbon credits that you can track, but...
Yeah, and they are highly regulated and the market is evolving. So I think, you can't have a bad ACCU, if that's a way of saying it. So I don't think it's ACCUs themselves, it's more holding out what the activities are to procure those ACCUs. That is more of a risk in terms of greenwashing. Was there a second part of that question?
Yeah, I think it was, to what level of transparency do you think there can or should be?
Yeah, and I think the...
Going to the point you just made about, obviously, the ACCUs can come from
sources. And it goes, it's a pricing thing as well. So different ACCUs, so different vintages, different ACCUs have different provenance and they will attract a higher price if they come from if they're fresh, they come from a scheme that has co-benefits. And that's all transparent and that's on the Clean Energy Regulator website. And on the registry itself. The register is moving, is changing, and there's a discussion paper out at the moment. We've done a blog post on that on our website, and that will introduce even more transparency and create a bit more confidence in the ACCU market. So it just depends on what companies are holding out on their websites.
I was interested to hear you talk about the provenance of ACCUs like an art dealer.
Yes.
But it is quite an interesting way it's developing, I guess.
Yeah,
Probably we don't have the answers to some of these questions.
No, because it is evolving. It's been around a while, but it is evolving and the types of methods are evolving and how... like I said, the HIR method in particular copped some flack. There are different methods that may attract, like sequestration type methods may, there's not many of them, but there's a lot more coming online, so it will definitely evolve over the next few years.
Yeah, and so the sequestration methods are more likely to be permanent, is that the...?
Yeah, that attracts the permanence. Obligations, so they're sort of locked in there for 25 years.
Yep. So I guess this is an allied question, maybe we've answered it to some degree, but what part should the ACCU scheme play in a company's ESG policy?
So I mean, I think the ACCU scheme is just part of decarbonisation plans. So the ACCU, you know, a large facility will need to reduce their emissions. They will have their own targets around how they're going to reduce emissions. The ACCU scheme is the regulated way of procuring ACCUs to offset, but there is a disincentive. So the as part of the safeguard mechanism reforms, the government is now requiring anyone who procures more than 30% of ACCUs to meet their emissions, to meet their baseline, to publish why they are procuring ACCUs. So ACCUs are kind of being pushed as a last resort compliance mechanism, and because of that, they're encouraging companies to do those structural abatement things that are on the board early on, rather than just relying on ACCUs. So in terms of what to report on ACCU, I mean, there are compulsory reporting requirements around that type of thing through sustainability reporting, which is not my I'm not a corporate governance lawyer, so I can't really advise on that. But the ACCU scheme definitely will form part of reporting requirements in annual reports and sustainability reports.
Yes, yeah, so more in a mandatory sense rather than a discretionary ESG element.
Yeah.
Okay. What about ACCUs adding to greenwashing?
Yeah,
any thoughts on that?
Oh gosh. No, I mean, they're a regulated market, so you can't sort of greenwash about them. But you may be able to greenwash around how you know what projects you're undertaking. But again, those projects need to follow the law. You know, they need to follow the methodology. They won't ACCUs won't be issued unless they tick all the right boxes. So it just depends on how that is being used, I guess, in terms of greenwashing.
Yeah, certainly given the amount of regulation you just quickly ran us through. It does seem that there's quite a few hurdles to actually arrive at getting an ACCU.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of hype about sustainable practices and you know, carbon farming and getting a lot of institutional investment into there. But the hype, when the rubber hits the road and you've actually got to get these projects up and running, they're actually quite difficult to, you know, there are regulations, there's lots of interplays with land access, and it's not as easy as first thought.
Understood. I think that was made pretty clear. I don't know if there are any questions from the floor.
Just pass you the mic.
Thank you. I was just wondering if the ACCU suffers an event where it's no longer recognised and you have to relinquish the ACCU, from a tax perspective, does that mean the asset never existed and you have to unwind everything that you did over the previous years in terms of recognising costs and revenue?
I think if it ceases to be held, that's an event under 420. I mean, it's an interesting one there as to whether the amounts, you know, the other activities, you know, you would have presumably claimed deductions along the way under other rules. Not necessarily sure that you'd automatically have a problem, but it sort of never existed. You may have still been, you know, carrying on those activities, and the eligibility for deductions under other rules, of course, are different and not specific in most cases, although sometimes there are. So it's probably for the activities themselves. It's a separate analysis, and more of a tax traditional analysis. Is there anything further to add?
Yeah, it's probably just worth clarifying, Tristan. You obviously talked about the trading stock rules, where you dispose of an ACCU to a third party, but where you just surrender an ACCU to the regulator to meet your, say, targets. How that's treated, as I understand it, there would be no deemed market value substitution in that case.
That's right. And the same should apply if it was cancelled. So you can, you know, relinquish it or surrender it to meet, you know, activities, or I suppose if it was actually cancelled because the carbon wasn't sequestered or stored or, you know, done appropriately, well, it still seems like to me that it's a bit of a ceasing to hold. You did actually hold it for a period. There isn't a specific rule about treating it as if it never existed. But that is an interesting topic, depending on exactly how that outcome was achieved under the other regulation.
So I guess the second part to that question would then be around administrative rules with timing, because some of these events are quite long in nature, whether it's 25 years or 100 years. Has there been given any thought to, well, maybe this is a question for the ATO, amending the rules so taxpayers can actually go backwards in time to correct disclosures, or would they have to amend in the current year for one of these events?
Yeah, I think what Tristan was saying was, I think the way the rules are meant to work is that you are either able to recognise the cost of the ACCU or the if you've generated it yourself or if you bought it from someone else, and then if you surrender it, you effectively do get recognition for that. I think is the expected design of the way the system should work in that situation. Any other questions? I might just quickly have a look back here. I think we've dealt with a lot of these questions. There is one question about whether SMCs are taxed the same in relation to ACCUs. The only thing that I'm aware of is there are some special rules for primary producers that are also into ACCUs. And more, as I understand it, around the averaging rules that sometimes play out for farmers in terms of averaging income, etc. But I must admit I haven't looked at those rules in details, but that's the only sort of other wrinkle out there that I was aware of.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there are some rules, yeah, for farmers or particularly individuals, which again is perhaps less relevant for our audience and wasn't something I was going to go into. On, you know, some of the timing issues can differ, as I mentioned before, with ACCUs that have been issued to you. I mean, the overall outcome at the end of the day when you eventually, you know, sell or surrender them should be the same. But there can be some timing mismatch issues for ACCUs issued to you that don't arise or shouldn't arise for SMCs. They are that particular deemed market value for the rolling balance is specific for ACCUs issued to you under the CFI Act.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks everyone for your questions. Thanks Naomi and Tristan for your valuable insights. We're now off for morning tea, as I understand it. Please fill in your evaluations if you have time. The feedback's always greatly appreciated, and we'll see you outside. Thanks everyone.